The Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Good morning, everybody. This is Richard Martin here from the Wake Up Call, and it's a sultry, dark, and sticky night here in Singapore, and hopefully it's nice with you in the United States. Well, the first thing that I want to tell you that is that we had a meetup group in New Brunswick yesterday, and by all accounts it went very well. There were several people there who had not been there before, which was nice, which is encouraging. The feedback that I got was that the concept of emigrating is still not resonating very strongly among people, and I guess either I'm not doing a very good job, or else the whole idea is really too confronting to come to terms with. The only thing I can say in advance of the moment, as it were, is that it's like investing. You know, you have to make a decision in advance of what you think is going to happen in order to be successful. You can't wait for an investment to get to a point at which you think it's safe to either buy or to sell short, because at that point you probably lost the opportunity. Of course, that's only investing. When it comes to emigrating, the situation is rather more grave. All I can do is to give you the kind of information that is endemic to what precedes a moment in which you really feel that the time has come to leave. In other words, the kind of police brutality that we saw, for example, over the weekend on Wall Street, you know, where they had the occupation of Wall Street, sit-ins, various people ranging from several hundred to several thousand people were there, and the police, quite unprovoked, and I saw videos of what happened, attacked these people, and it was really quite egregious to see that. And when you look and you see what's going on in the country worldwide, I had a nasty run-in myself with the police. There was no violence involved, but there was very unreasonable behavior on the part of the police towards my wife and myself in our car, and this was 3 years ago, so, you know, this was way, way in advance. There are unpleasant things happening right now, and there are various reasons for why I think that it is essential to consider the possibility of emigrating, not least of which is the impossibility of living in an environment where the forces of law and order have become so arrogant that they paid no attention at all to the consequences of their actions. And their actions consequently become more and more invasive, more and more brutal, like, you know, entering into a house unannounced with no warrant and then getting a court order after the event stating that they were entitled to do that, and then the police, you know, get away scot-free, basically. There are all kinds of inroads that are taking place into your freedoms. And because of the nature of the United States and the kind of country that it set out to be, I think that the consequences of everything that's happening right now are likely to be much more severe than they would be in other first world countries that suffer economic hardship and indeed social breakdown. Now, of course, I'm going to be talking a lot more about that as time goes on. I'm going to give you lots of information, hopefully, that will come that I will be able to pick up. And you, the listeners, if you feel inclined to call in, please feel free. I mean, I'd love to hear from you. But the main point is that by the time it comes clear that you need to leave, it is going to be too late. It's already too late to emigrate to certain countries, and I fear that Singapore is one of them. There are just huge numbers of people now coming from the West, especially from the United States, knocking on the door of Singapore, trying to get work here. Obviously, the immigration department is going to be inundated with requests. It's going to be much harder. I would almost venture to say that it's over as far as Singapore is concerned. But there are lots of other places, and lots of places even in third world countries which need the likes of your good selves to come in and, you know, give a helping hand and probably gain some experience, and who knows what else might come of it. But in the first stages, I want it to be much more clear and focused for you as to why you should want to leave. And basically, we had this come up yesterday, I think, at the meetup group. And there were lots of people talking, I believe, about immigration. And yet, I think the general feeling was that people don't really feel that motivated, which is understandable. I mean, it's not that easy a task. Just know, as I've said before, that there have been plenty of places in the world where immigration has suddenly become important, urgent, with no particular preparations, people have had to leave. And I'm just thinking of South Africa, the whites that were threatened with troubles in South Africa back in the 90s, that had basically to leave, to get up and go at absolutely a moment's notice. They saw what happened to the whites in Rhodesia, which is now, of course, Zimbabwe, the way they were slaughtered and basically had their properties taken away from them. Not that I'm saying that that's going to happen in the United States, but there are always different reasons for why people need to emigrate. And I just feel that the United States is going to come to a point where people will truly wish they had immigrated. People who don't even know anything about it today, people who've never listened to the wake-up call, who've never had any intimation that this might become necessary. Anyway, we'll talk more about it. Thank you for coming, those of you who came to the meeting. I don't know when the next one will be held, but I hope it will be not too long before you have another opportunity to get together. Okay, well, usually when I talk about the background to the current crisis, I discuss it from a direct economic vantage point. And I usually start with the breakdown of the gold standard in 1971, because that always seems to me to be the most convenient moment of truth. And it is also true that without Nixon's fateful decision, this crisis that we are experiencing now could actually never have happened. But let's look at it for a moment in a more macro context and see how overall trends led to where we are today. However it may seem, the current crisis didn't come out of nowhere. Following World War II, the government and employers were keen to appease a population weary from years of war and rationing. And in England, that was really done through the initiation of the National Health Service, which was founded in 1948 and gave the people of Britain the opportunity to get what in the States would be called single-payer health services, which before that were unheard of. Also the government provided the opportunity for a reconstruction boom, and that in itself created the possibility of productivity deals, as they say. And these were agreements between employers and the unions for workers to implement productivity improvements in return for a share of the profits in the form of higher wages. Now, those of you who are fairly advanced in years, shall we say, will probably remember this. Wages, of course, increased. There was no political reason why they should, but what the government managed to do was to provide a sort of panacea for the horrors of war to those who needed work. They encouraged work. In other words, they sort of basically did all the right things. And this really lasted up until the late 1960s, when, tragically, two factors converged to derail it. First, there was a growing wave of industrial unrest with strikes and other forms of action, which were felt really around the world, especially in first world countries, and you certainly will remember them from the United States. And of course, many of these took the form of wildcat action outside union control. Workers were fed up with years of producing more and more while their lives were still reduced to work, as all that extra productivity hadn't led to shorter hours as they had been promised. Now, the second factor was the end of the post-war boom, which saw economic growth slow dramatically, making productivity deals unaffordable if profit levels were to be maintained. And it also saw rising inflation eating away at the wage improvements of the previous decades, which of course added fuel to the fire of workers' militancy. The struggles of this period were highly successful, and workers did win large concessions. But this set the stage for a concerted counterattack. At the end of the 1970s, Margaret Thatcher came to power in the UK on a mission to break the working class, and Reagan soon followed in the US, and both of them isolated and took on workers sector by sector, doing deals with some unions while attacking others in a divide-and-rule strategy. The decisive defeats were, in the UK, the miners' strike of 1984-1985, and in the US, Reagan's attack on the air traffic controllers in 1981, which I'm sure some of you will remember. And by the way, both of these are defeats from which we've yet to recover. When with workers broken, Thatcher and Reagan then set about a series of reforms which set the scene for today's crisis. Firstly, old centers of workers' militancy in both mining and manufacturing were systematically dismantled and outsourced to low-wage economies overseas. And whereas in the UK in 1971, over 70% of people were employed in primary industries like mining or manufacturing, today over 70% of workers are in the service sector. Well, secondly, the banking sector was massively deregulated, allowing the creation of all sorts of complicated derivatives markets, which ultimately resulted in the credit crunch, as it proved impossible to know what all these pieces of paper were really worth. And I'm going to be talking about that a little bit later on in the show. An effect of breaking workers' militancy was, of course, to keep wages down. And we've all got used to sub-inflation pay rises every year, otherwise known as pay cuts. Now, while this boosts profits, of course, the problem with this is that it keeps consumer spending, and thus economic growth, down on a quasi-permanent basis, since you can't buy lots of things when you're skint, unless, of course, you've got a credit card. So, of course, the problem was solved by extending massive consumer credit, based mostly on rising house prices, which provided the spending power to purchase all those commodities coming out of the new manufacturing centers in the Far East and elsewhere. Now, parallel to this, without primary industries or manufacturing, the economy came to rely more and more on the banking and financial sector, with what we call the square mile of the City of London alone accounting for about 5% of the UK economy. This sector was also now heavily reliant on rising house prices, with complicated mortgage derivatives being one of the major assets held by the banks. Of course, when the housing bubble burst, everything started to unravel. Household name banks teetered on the brink of collapse, as did the entire financial system. Credit dried up, and with it the economy swung into recession. There is much talk comparing it to the collapse of 1929, except nobody knows how bad it's going to get, and this time it's global. Already there have been riots by workers laid off from thousands of factories in China, and food riots across the globe as food prices rise much faster than incomes. Well, this then is the context for the coming clawback attacks on our living standards that are set to try and make us pay for a crisis that, frankly, was not of our own making. All right, let's just stop here for a few moments while I give out my info quickly. And by the way, before I forget, if anybody who was at the meetup group yesterday would like to call in and talk about what you all discussed, please feel free to do so. I'm sure we'd all love to hear what you have to say. And the number for all of you is the same as ever, 888-874-4888. Again, that is our toll-free call-in number for any reason under the sun. And the more exotic, I guess, the more fun it'll be. So let's have your calls, ladies and gentlemen, at 888-874-4888. Now, those of you who would prefer to email me can do so with your questions at any time during the show, and they will be gratefully received. And it will be rm@gfawd.com. That's RM for Richard Martin at GFAWD for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design .com. Once more, RM@gfawd.com. And finally, if you want to call me personally with your personal, economic, financial, and other conundra, you may do that in private by calling me on my direct line at 941, that's area code 941 in Sarasota, Florida, 941-441-1682. Again, that's 941-441-1682. Well, what to my mind is so strange about the current situation isn't the decline of profits in the global economy in the late 1960s or the serious downturn of the 1970s, but the fact that a real depression didn't materialize until 2007. The Great Depression in the 1930s was similar to earlier crises in that it was followed by a war, the enormous destructive force of the Second World War, all of which laid the foundations for the new prosperity that came to life in the post-war golden age. The new prosperity began to decline by the end of the 1960s, and of course this prosperity didn't come without the usual payoff, more war. Governments, the U.S. government above all, printed massive amounts of money to pay for all this spending. They extended credit to the private financial establishments, and the central banks were encouraged to extend money to corporate and individual borrowers. All this made possible the debt expansion that underwrote individual consumption, corporate acquisitions, and from the 1980s, ever more forms of speculation in real estate, the stock market, and, with the refinement of derivatives, the ups and downs of speculation itself. This ever-increasing public, business, and individual debt appeared on bank and other business balance sheets as profits, despite any real productive enterprise. Meanwhile, just as in earlier periods of economic decline, pressure was put on workers to work harder, while labor costs were lowered by moving plants from high-wage to low-wage areas, or simply by using the threat of such moves to cut wages and benefits. Starting in the 1980s, spending on the socialized wage payments constituted by welfare state programs was cut, freeing up money for corporate use. As it was supposed to, all this contributed to an actual increase in profits by lowering production costs, but evidently not by enough, given the costs of production goods, to make possible a new round of capital investment on a scale able to challenge the charms of speculation's short-run high returns. The result was the economic situation which has arrived so shockingly during the last year, though for several decades the warning signs, which were debt crises, recessions, bank collapses, stock market failures, they were clear enough. Well, generally ascribed to lax regulation, greed, or bad central bank policy, the current economic collapse is in line with the whole history of capitalism as a system. What we are faced with today is, more or less, the depression that should have come much earlier, but which political economic policy was able to delay, in part, by displacing it to poor parts of the world, but largely by an historically unprecedented creation of debt in the rich parts for 30-odd years. Now, keep in mind that they are using false government statistics to correct for inflation. Real inflation is multiples of reported inflation, and therefore the real effect of the middle class squeeze is even more dramatic. Lost decade? Get ready for more. Get real. Get involved in things not built around paper fluff. You know, we're hearing a lot these days about the European crisis. But many in the United States will want to know just how it is affecting them. We absolutely cannot ignore the implications of a European collapse on the American economy. History provides a clue as to how bad things can get when the triggering events happen in other countries. And while we often look back for the Great Depression as being October 1929 and the stock market crash, the reality is that the Great Depression went global and full force when European nations defaulted on their debt obligations and their economies crumbled. The situation is starkly similar to what we face today, and according to George Soros, may go full circle very soon. Well, Greece, Portugal, and Ireland, they're all toast. They're finished. And there is nothing that can be done to save their economies. But they're not the only ones. Spain and Italy are in the same boat, with many smaller European Union countries also facing serious debt problems. It appears the authorities have reached the end of the road with their policy of kicking the can down the road, even if a catastrophe can be avoided. One thing is certain. The pressure to reduce deficits will push the Eurozone into prolonged recession. This will have incalculable political consequences. The catastrophe cannot be avoided, and the consequences will be civil unrest across Europe and the real possibility of a complete collapse of the EU economic, monetary, and political systems. Back in 2008, Secretary Henry Paulson and others suggested that we were facing the legitimate possibility of another depression, and one congressman actually said on the House floor that congressional leaders were told that there would be martial law on the streets of America. President Obama's administration and their mouthpieces in mainstream media have told us that they actually prevented this greater depression from taking place. Yet global political and financial leaders continue to suggest that a Great Depression is imminent. Of course, they never run out of solutions for the problems we face, leaving the majority of the public in Europe and America holding on to the idea that they know what's best. And if given carte blanche over the governments and central banks of the world, they will save us. In his book, The Crash of 2008 and What It Means, George Soros writes, and I quote, "The year 1944 was the formative experience of my life. I shall not give a detailed account of it because my father has done it better than I could. Imagine a child of 14 coming from a middle-class background suddenly confronted with the prospect of being deported and killed just because he is Jewish. Fortunately, my father was well prepared for this, far from equilibrium experience. He had lived through the Russian Revolution in Siberia, and that was the formative experience of his life. When the Germans occupied Hungary on March the 19th, 1944, my father knew these were not normal times, and the normal rules didn't apply. Every few generations throughout our history, we have experienced what Soros refers to as far from equilibrium situations or unthinkable situations, when the political, economic, and or social stability of entire nations or societies is threatened. You really do need to be prepared for this, because by all indications, the unthinkable is exactly what we are facing today. Let's use the lessons of history to survive and thrive when the world around us falls apart. Well, according to Fitch Ratings, the 10 largest U.S. prime money market funds had total assets of $658 billion as of July the 31st, 2011. Of those assets, $309 billion, an unsettling 47% of the total, represented debt obligations issued by European banks. It's unclear what level of subordination these debt obligations take, but we can expect that in the event of a Greek default, this concentrated ownership of European bank debt by U.S. money market funds will be less than, shall we say, ideal for investor confidence. The heavy allocation of U.S. savings to the European banking system strikes me as an awful example of moral hazard produced by two forces: the 2008-2009 bank bailouts, and also a European regulatory structure which doesn't require those banks to hold any capital against holdings of European government debt, including that of Greece. As we saw in the housing crisis, when you have a weak regulatory structure encouraging unaccountable leverage, and, as we know, irresponsible monetary policies encouraging the reach for yield, the combined result is predictably disastrous. All right, well, ladies and gentlemen, I think we will take this opportunity to have our break. It's a few moments earlier than normal, but I'm sure Matt will oblige. And so let's have the break now, and then I will be right back.
And speaking of big problems for the president, more and more economists in this country are talking about the possibility of a double-dip recession. Lakshman Achitan, the managing director of the Economic Cycle Research Institute, famously predicted the 2008 collapse, and then, last summer, he was ahead of the curve again in predicting the end of the recession. But today, well, Achitan says the odds of a return to recession are more and more likely.
People are getting worried again, and when you look at the forward-looking indicators, they're pointing to continued slowing ahead. And when our growth is already so weak, that means we are skating on very thin ice. The risk of recession in front of us, of a new recession, is quite high. And the jury remains out as to whether or not we're going to go into a recession. We don't have enough information to say it definitively, but I suspect we will have that information by Thanksgiving to know one way or another.
Here's what I wonder. A lot of economists and pundits are talking about a double-dip recession, right?
Yeah.
Going back into recession. But but as you know, for many people in this country, it doesn't really feel like we ever left the recession anyway.
Correct.
So what happens if we go into double-dip recession? How will things change substantially for a vast segment of the American population that is suffering anyway?
As unbelievable as it may sound, they are going to suffer more. They are in a depression. That is a depression for that cohort. And it poses massive problems for policymakers, because a new recession automatically increases all of these expenditures out of the public sector, while at the same time dramatically decreasing all their revenue. So there's even less ability to help the people who are hurting the most.
Now, some economists are arguing that right now we're just in a period of slow growth, not that different from the early 1980s, and that there may be some light I'm not going to say at the end of the tunnel, but maybe just slightly over the bend in the hill. What do you make of that?
I don't have any evidence to support that kind of view.
You have no good news for us.
I'm afraid, and no, in the near term, I don't at all. The best news I can give you is that cycles do turn, but there's going to be a lot of pain in between. And This is very different than the early 1980s. The issues that ail the U.S. economy and the jobs market today are not things that result from nearby events. What we're living through and dealing with now has been building for decades. If you look at the data, you see that the pace of expansion has been stair-stepping down ever since the 1970s on all counts, on production, how much can we produce, how many jobs can we create, how much money do we make, how much do we sell. These are all trending down. The pace of expansion has been getting weaker and weaker for decades. It's not something that is new. So those who were expecting we should have a vigorous recovery had no right to do so. Rather, we're likely to see more frequent recessions than anyone is used to for the next 5 or 10 years.
Sobering news from Lakshman Atitan. He's the managing director of the Economic Cycle Research Institute, and he joined me from New York. Lakshman, let's bring you back on. We have something good to tell us.
Check back in a couple of months, and maybe we avoid a recession.
Thanks very much.
Okay.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I played that clip to you because Lakshman Atitan is, in fact, a very, very savvy commentator, an analyst. He never sugarcoats the pill. And he is extraordinarily accurate in his prognostications. And I think it's difficult to trade off his advice because you never know when he's going to change, and he's quite unequivocal in his views. One day he can be bullish and the next day he can be bearish. But what he has said this time round indicates that he is clearly looking more pessimistic for an extended period of time in terms of the economy. And whenever you get a chance to listen to him in any kind of interview, I strongly suggest that you take the opportunity to do so. Again, his name is Lakshman Atitan, and he comments quite frequently on the financial press and the media, but you have to look for him because he's not always announced well in advance. There you have it, a very good guide, a very reliable indication as to what is going to happen in the future. Well, looking a little bit more at some of the banks in the United States, which we haven't done for a while, I think it pays to do so. The latest quarterly report from the Office of the Currency Comptroller shows that the top four banks in the U.S. now account for a massively disproportionate amount of the derivative risk in the financial system, specifically of the $250 trillion in gross notional amount of derivative contracts outstanding, which, by the way, consists of interest rate, foreign exchange, equity contracts, commodities, and CDSs. And those spread among the top 25 commercial banks, a number, by the way, which swells to $333 trillion when looking at the top 25 bank holding companies. A mere five banks, and actually four, account for 95.9% of all derivative exposure. And those top four banks are J.P. Morgan with $78.1 trillion, Citibank with $56 trillion, Bank of America, $53 trillion, and Goldman Sachs with $48 trillion. And they account for 94.4% of total exposure. Now, I won't go into details about what each of these banks holds, but what I have just told you can amount to a definition of too big to fail right there. The biggest banks are not only getting bigger, but their risk exposure is now at a new all-time high and up $5.3 trillion from the first quarter, as they do have to risk ever more in the derivatives markets to generate that incremental penny of return. I mean, it's amazing. The top five banks have virtually 100% of all credit derivatives held by American banks. Now, let's just look in a little bit further into this. Let's see what this means. First of all, the amount of derivatives dwarfs the size of the world economy, as I'm sure you can imagine. As Bloomberg reported in May, Mark Mobius, executive chairman of Templeton Asset Management, said that another financial crisis is inevitable because the causes of the previous one hadn't been resolved. And I quote, "There is definitely going to be another financial crisis around the corner because we haven't solved any of the things that caused the previous crisis. Are the derivatives regulated? No. Are you still getting growth in derivatives? Yes." End of quote. The total value of derivatives in the world exceeds total global gross domestic product by a factor of 10. And with that volume of bets in different directions, volatility and equity market crises have to occur. The global financial crisis 3 years ago was caused in part by the proliferation of derivatives products tied to U.S. home loans that ceased performing. And that triggered hundreds of billions of dollars in write-downs and led to the collapse of Lehman Brothers in September 2008. Credit default swaps were largely responsible for bringing down Bear Stearns, AIG, Washington Mutual, and other mammoth corporations. And unexpected changes in interest rates could cause a major bloodbath in interest rate derivatives. And no, incredibly, there have been no reforms or any attempts to rein in derivatives. And the Dodd-Frank financial legislation was really just a PR stunt, which really didn't change anything. But the big banks and their minions claim that the huge amounts of derivatives themselves are unimportant because these are only notional values. And, after netting, the notional values are deflated to a much more modest number. But at this point, the economist PhD people will say, this is total rubbish. After all, you have bilateral netting, which eliminates net bank exposure almost entirely. And that's, by the way, what the OCC will say as well, the Office of the Currency Controller. According to the chief regulator of the derivatives space in QE2, netting benefits amounted to an almost record 90.8% of gross exposure. So while seemingly massive, those infinite trillion numbers are actually quite small, right? Well, actually, no. The problem with bilateral netting is that it's based on one massively flawed assumption, which is that in an orderly collapse, all derivative contracts will be honored by the issuing bank. The best example of how the flaw behind bilateral netting almost destroyed the system is AIG. The insurance company was hours away from making trillions of derivatives contracts worthless if it were to implode, leaving all those who had bought protection from the firm worthless, a contingency only Goldman hedged by buying protection on AIG. And while the argument can further be extended that in bankruptcy a perfectly netted bankrupt entity would make someone else whole on claims they have written, this is not true, as the bankrupt estate will pursue 100% recovery on its claims even under Chapter 11, while claims the estate had written end up as general unsecured claims, which, as Lehman has demonstrated, will collect 20 cents on the dollar if they're lucky. The point of this all is that if any of these four banks fails, the repercussions would be disastrous. And no, Frank Dodd's bank resolution provision would do absolutely nothing to prevent an epic systemic collapse. Well, let's take a couple of emails at this point. One from Jolly Jones, who writes in saying, "Hello, Richard. Thanks for your show, and keep up the great work. It's interesting to try forecasting the U.S.'s destiny. I have recently started backing off the chaos scenario. I believe most Americans will continue to see their standard of living slowly decline, but the elite, along with the Fed, simply won't let things get out of hand. They have too much to lose. Social unrest will lead to the iron boot. Any thoughts?" Well, Yes, Johnny, I do have thoughts. I mean, the problem in America, I always keep coming back to the problem of the higher standard of living in the first world countries, from which a fall is much more of a jolt than it would be for countries in the third world whose standard of living may or may not fall, but they are already poor. You see, the problem in America is that, for better or for worse, America has always considered its birthright to be one of an increased standard of living. Nobody has ever discussed with any demographic in America, the older people, the middle-aged people, or the young people, nobody has ever discussed the possibility that there might be a serious economic drawdown. It's always been considered that American, young Americans will have it better than their parents, and their parents in turn have, as a general rule, had it better than their grandparents. Although, really, there has been no net increase in living standards since the late 60s, early 70s. But now we are going to see a massive decline. And the problem with the decline is that it comes with immense resentment, immense unhappiness, and frankly, it was just that very resentment that drove me out of the United States. I simply couldn't take any longer the sullen attitudes that people would mete out to me, and people in positions of power, people in positions of responsibility. I mean, I do have unpleasant stories to tell about my final 3 or 4 years in the United States. Yes, sure I do, and I'm sure everybody else has horrific things to say about things that have happened to them. But that, ladies and gentlemen, is only a beginning. Nobody is being honest with you. Nobody is telling you what's going on, what is happening. You know, I sit here telling you about notional derivative values, and it probably your eyes glaze over because you haven't really that much understanding of what I'm talking about. And, you know, I only have 2 hours in the week. I simply don't have time to discuss these things in any great detail. I did, several years ago, talk a lot in many shows about derivatives. So those who've been with me from a while back will probably be able to recall some of the things I used to say. But the fact is that the economic, the financial powers that be in America have behaved grotesquely irresponsibly. They lost their minds. They truly lost their minds. They didn't know what they were doing. They could not understand the seriousness of the nonsense that they were foisting on the rest of the world. These people that sold mortgages that never should have seen the light of day, they truly didn't know what they were doing. Of course, those that designed them knew perfectly well what they were doing. But those who sold them were basically inveigled into selling products that they were assured by their superiors were viable products. And they didn't think. They didn't think about the consequences of what they were doing. But we're past that now. Now we are on the downward slope, the consequences part, something that America has never had to deal with before, the consequences of the actions of other people. And they are going to be grim. And nobody can really understand how grim they're going to be, including me, because as things get worse, they infect other areas of our lives which we can't see in advance. But I can tell you that there is no solution. If you understand that there is no solution, if you will ignore all the pundits that tell you that by pushing more money into the system, that listening to Ben Bernanke or Tim Geithner or President Obama or anybody else, you will gain any sense of security, if you will ignore that, if you will put that out of your minds and realize that these people are floating in ignorance just as much as you are, then you will come somewhat close to understanding that there are consequences which are unforeseen and absolutely execrable. And that's the kind of thing that will make you wonder what kind of a future you really will have in the United States of America. Okay, well, it is clearly a terrible situation that we have to deal with, and as I say, I will do my best to fill you in on the details as and when they become available. Well, I'd say it's official by now. The first decade of the 21st century will go down in the history books as a step back for the American middle class. Last week, the government made gloomy headlines when it released the latest census report showing the poverty rate rising to a 17-year high. 46.2 million people, or 15.1% of the U.S. population, now live in poverty, and 49.9 million live without health insurance. But the data also gave the first glimpse of what happened to middle-class incomes in the first decade of the millennium. While the earnings of middle-income Americans have barely budged since the mid-1970s, the new data showed that from 2000 to 2010, they actually regressed. For American households in the middle of the pay scale, income fell to $49,445 last year when adjusted for inflation, a level not seen since 1996. And over the 10-year period, their income is down 7%. And according to Jared Bernstein, senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, and I quote, "Economists talk about the lost decade in Japan. Well, with these 2010 data, we can confirm the lost decade for the American middle class. We have experienced macroeconomic debt saturation. Adding more debt into that situation beyond the saturation point only works to drag down the economy, which must service all the principal and interest. Servicing all that debt is what kills monetary velocity. The money simply circles back around to the bank. Past the saturation point, new debt is issued to service old debt, and there simply isn't enough income left over to create real growth or real jobs." Now think about that, ladies and gentlemen. Think about what that means. When you take out a loan, you have to be able to pay that loan back. Now when you pay that loan back, you pay it out of your income. And your income is that which is left over after you paid all your running costs, your fixed costs. You know, your insurance, your mortgage, the gas that you need to spend to go to work every day, your food, all your living expenses, that which is left over will pay the interest. Now, we're talking about a national situation here where the interest that is left over after the national expenses are paid simply is not adequate. And that's what's causing the inability of people to progress economically. There simply isn't enough money left over from all the payments that have been made to create any more wealth. That's why it's so depressing, because there's no way in the foreseeable future for that situation to change. So be that as it may, let us now take another email. Let us take an email from Chad, who writes in saying, "Hi Richard, I'm a loyal listener to your show. I recently left a position as a project manager at a large cell phone company. I have rolled my 401k, which was in a money market account, to a treasury money market fund in an IRA. I'm hoping this was the best strategy for me at this time. My accounts are with T. Rowe Price, so the ticker of the new treasury fund is PRTXX. I'm hoping you can take a look and share your opinion with me. My questions for you. One, is this a safe short-term treasury fund? If not, what is the best way to hold short-term treasuries? Two, lastly, with the Bernanke's latest scheme of selling short-term treasuries to buy 30-year long-term paper, will this negatively impact short-term treasury holders? Thanks a million for all you do, Chad S." All right, well, I called Chad, and we had a chat during which I asked him to send me the breakdown of his so-called treasury fund. Ladies and gentlemen, this is what he sent back. 52% repurchase agreements which has nothing to do with Treasury notes or bills or any other Treasury paper. Under the 10 largest holdings, it lists several banks, including General Electric Capital Corp, among others. It has 18% in what they call other U.S. government securities and agencies, and just 20% in U.S. Treasury notes and 8% in T-bills. Well, ladies and gentlemen, a word to the wise. This is officially called the T. Rowe Price U.S. Treasury Money Market Fund, and it is no such thing. Now, this points up what I've been saying over and over again. You need to check when you are offered a Treasury bill, money market fund, some other such issue. You need to check inside under the hood to find out what exactly lies within. And as a matter of fact, I haven't spoken to Chad since I found this out. I told Chad in an email that I would be talking about his products on the show. So, Chad, I hope you're listening, and I hope you're getting the message here. But it is extremely important. People, and I'm talking about money, bank officers, brokers, I mean, they genuinely don't know. They're not trying to sell you something underhand. They have no idea. They read like you do. This is a Treasury money market fund. They assume it's true. And so, you know, it's unfortunately up to you to check what these Treasury money market funds may contain before you sign on. And again, as I always say, ladies and gentlemen, especially after what I told you earlier on in the show about the problems of the money market, the commercial money market funds in the United States investing in Europe, and the dangers that is showing as we speak, make absolutely sure that your funds are held in either FDIC-insured products or in Treasury bills or Treasury bill money market funds, exclusively in Treasury bills. Okay? All right, well, I had an email from who very, very kindly wanted to draw my attention to the to a new movie which is put out by Al Jazeera. And it's described as Meltdown. I don't think it's not actually called Meltdown, but it's described as a four-part investigation into a world of greed and recklessness that led to financial collapse. And her comment was, after watching this, I had a visceral reaction. I had to take a shower and try to wash it off. Unconscionable. Well, that's Anne McKithen's reaction to the movie. Let me give you the details, ladies and gentlemen. Hopefully you have a pen and paper handy. What you really want to do is to go to Al Jazeera, which is, and I'll just give you the website here. It's http, you know, /// english.aljazeera.net. Now, Al Jazeera is spelled Aljazeera. That's aljazeera.net. Once more, put in english.aljazeera.net. Let me spell that once more for you. Aljazeera. When the page comes up, when the home page comes up, put into the search engine the following: The Men Who Crashed the World. Now, that, I believe, is the title of the movie. I've watched about 5 minutes of it, and it really looks pretty good to me, so I'm going to rely on Anne's judgment here and my own glimpse of the beginning of this to advise you again. Put into the search engine, let me repeat that, The Men Who Crashed the World, as I believe that is the title of the movie. So do watch it, and if you have any comments, do let me know what they are, and I hope to be able to pass those on to company present. All right, so Johnny Jones, I believe we did, yes, we dealt with Johnny Jones's contribution. I found an interesting article at Naked Capitalism by Eve Smith, which had to do with the decline in manufacturing, from which I thought I would read you an excerpt. It seems to me a remarkable comment. You know, why do those at the top of the food chain not like manufacturing? It's physical. Plants are located where land is cheap, which usually means in the boonies, and powerful people don't hang out in the boonies. Production facilities are noisy, dirty, and dangerous. Arms merchants benefit not only from government-funded research and development, but also from the very long product lives assured by government contracts. Look at the subsidies Big Pharma enjoys. The U.S. has hesitated to push back within the WTO framework. It filed cases against China in certain areas, such as tires, only to have China file tit-for-tat cases against the U.S., such as poultry. There was a careful effort to keep the dollar amounts at issue in a rough correspondence. The Department of Commerce at first seemed interested in, then declined to file cases against, Chinese and Indonesian coated paper manufacturers. But the program was the same, large-scale subsidies. There you go, ladies and gentlemen. Been a pleasure talking to you. I will be back on Friday. This is Richard Martin from the Wake Up Call, wishing you well until then. Take care. Bye-bye.